bunch of Apple news to talk about this week, starting with what I, to me, was like the biggest story of the week. And it's that Apple's Magic Keyboard, which is the keyboard trackpad case for iPad Pro, is available to order now and shipping as soon as, I think, Monday. So that's like April the 20th or so, which is not in May, which is like under promising and over delivering in the best way possible.
Yeah, I guess it's just like a big sign of how volatile the supply chain is that 3 weeks ago, Apple was promising this product wouldn't come until May, and many of us assumed that'd be later in May. And then out of the blue, it's been pushed up by, you know, probably 3 weeks from what original estimates were, and is shipping before May even starts. So,
yeah, unless if you order on Amazon, it's still May 30th, I assume. No, I don't know.
They'll update it at some point. But yeah. I think if you order now from Apple, the shipping date's already pushed out to May 1st because they've run out of initial stock. So, So it's clearly still a supply constrained product, but you know, with the coronavirus flaring about, but China seems to be somewhat getting back on its feet, right? And at least in limited capacity, and certainly supply chain production is back up and running, and clearly faster than Apple initially estimated. That's why they're being able to push it out sooner.
Yeah, I know that this is something that I'm just, I cannot wait to try this out, because you know, we don't know if it's going to be good or bad, you know, or just kind of meh. But in concept, it seems like it promises a lot in terms of, you know, hey, you've got a first class trackpad and keyboard, and you know, a case that gives your iPad viewing angles for the first time, and you know, from an Apple case, and it seems really easy to use. Like, put it on, put it off, you know, take it and leave it. But so I can't wait to try it next week. I ordered one as soon as possible, the 11-inch version for the 11-inch iPad Pro. And, you know, I guess I saw someone did like a pretty cool graphic that was comparing the smart keyboard for iPad Pro with the Magic Keyboard. And it was just based on like Apple's pictures online close-ups and like trying to like line up the iPad as like a constant and then the variable being the keyboard. And, you know, certainly it's going to be thicker, but like I can imagine it being worth that thickness and weight, you know, from what you get from it.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely going to be heavier than their current cases, but I don't think it's going to be so outrageous that that would be the problem. The biggest question is just about that, you know, seemingly impossible cantilever stand component, right?
Yeah.
Is it easy enough to actually take it off and on, like with the magnetic clasp? Without you having to like fiddle about with it or hold it down, can you literally, like what they do in the advert, just pop it on and it snaps and take it straight off without the whole thing moving all over the place? Is it going to fall over when it's in your lap? That's the kind of thing that's, and exactly how many angles can you put it at? Because they quote like 130 degrees of angles, but it's not clear like what those angles are. Like, can you have it like perfectly vertical, for instance? You know,
right.
What I mean, like,
yeah.
That's the kind of thing that we have to wait in, or how far down can it go? Like, if you're in a plane or whatever, can you actually pull it back further enough that it's not going to be a pain? Because unlike the previous cases, this one will not fold on its back and just be like a, you know, an A-shape apex or like a little tent so you can just watch a video or whatever, because it doesn't have that mode, right. So the only way to do it is to be, you know, with it cantilevered back and then folding forward. So it really hinges, pardon the pun, on how that stand works. Yes. To be like, is this actually like a really, really great product, or is it mediocre? If it's like what the adverts show, then I think it's going to be fantastic. Expensive, for sure, but you know, worth the price if it is actually as good as what those adverts are. If it's not as good, and worth the price is different to being a popular product, right?
Because
I think if you have a lot of, I think a lot of normal people would not spend that much money on keyboard accessories. I would if I had a 2018 iPad Pro,
yeah.
2020 Pro, I would 100% bought one because I think it's cool. I'd buy just like the stand part, like not even the keyboard, the trackpad part. If they just sold like a $150 stand, which you could put on your desk and you just like snap it on for like on your bedside table, I'd buy that on its own because it's kind of like a more modern version of like the Logi Base thing that they used to have, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that stand part is just awesome.
Yes.
And then, you know, the trackpad's cool as well.
Yeah, so yeah, I can't wait for it. I will certainly discuss it next week, as it should be here. So I'm looking forward to that. Something that you have now is Logitech's like half the price of this thing, but keyboard and trackpad for non-pro iPads. And that's also available to order now too, but you've got it in person as a review unit. So how's that going?
Yeah. So this is the Logitech Combo Touch case. It's kind of a silly name, but this is one that they've actually collaborated with Apple on, because it appeared on the store the same day as the Magic Keyboard did, like the listing and the product information. And so we've seen like some third party manufacturers already come out with iPad keyboard cases with trackpads integrated to them based on the iOS 13 accessibility stuff, right? But this one should be more reliable and more responsive than the other efforts, because they did actually, you know, work alongside Apple to basically have the good trackpad experience, not the kind of like hacked together one. And I got it early today. I've been playing about with it. It's pretty good. The biggest like downside is the trackpad's responsive in, you know, scrolling or dragging the mouse around. But the actual like ergonomics of the trackpad are kind of jarring when you're used to, you know, like a 15-inch MacBook Pro with its massive trackpad, or even like the external Magic trackpad. Those things are just ginormous, and the trackpad you get on these cases is very, very small, right? Like it's probably like a fifth the size almost. And then on the Logitech one, it's not a like haptic touch trackpad type arrangement. It's like the old laptops with the little diving board clicky thing. So, and on my unit at least, the top like third of this relatively small trackpad area, you can't click it. Like it's just completely taut. You have to click the lower side of it to actually click. If you're not using tap to click, if you're using, you know, like the physical depression, and so that's kind of like a pain. And it's not like a software integration thing. It's just like a limitation of the hardware. The Magic Keyboard from Apple is like marketed as tap anywhere, right? But
yeah, click anywhere, which could hopefully doesn't just mean like tap to touch or tap to click, but means like physical click anywhere. And you know, I guess my impressions will largely be something I could already know if I use the trackpad with the iPad today, because I've only used a mouse with the iPad since cursor support has been top level. But just, you know, I've got a ton of muscle memory from the Mac book, and I know there's things that you cannot do, like three-finger drag won't be one, which you can do on the Mac. Used to be a default, and now it's like an accessibility feature, but it's great.
Yeah, because three-finger drag on iPad OS is the multitasking gestures.
Right, and so just that muscle memory being broken will be too bad, but and that will kind of inform my impressions, is like, you know, is it worth the hassle? Does it make the iPad more like, you know, in my use case, you know, it can be tablet mode like I use it now, but can it also be much closer to doing what I do on the laptop with the iPad? And it sounds like, well, I mean, all I can say is that from the Logitech stuff, it's, I think comparing it to the Mac is tough, and that in the use cases that you see where it's for iPads that cost less and it's an accessory that costs less than like the pro level stuff, then you kind of compare it to just like using an iPad with nothing else to suddenly.
Like obviously I'm coming from,
you know,
because when you're using it, it does feel like you're using a laptop. So your instant impressions are comparison to, you know, the laptop experience that I use day in and day out. And when I like tweet a picture of it, everyone's like, is the trackpad like the Apple trackpad? And it's like, yeah, responsive wise, yes, but it's just small. And like, even like the three finger gestures, they work great on the Logitech one, and like the Bridge keyboards, the three finger gestures don't work at all, right? So because of the Apple collaboration, the three finger gestures will work, the two finger gestures work, it's great, but it's just such a small area that I'm not used to. And, you know, if I was switching to an iPad full time, you'd probably get, you know, adjust more to the smaller size. And if you're at a desk arrangement, maybe you'd pair an external trackpad as well, like the external Magic trackpad.
Yep.
If you're looking just for like a portable laptop, you probably get away with it. But if you're used to like the premium MacBook experience, you're going to be, you know, you're going to be underwhelmed, because it's a compromise, right? Like all of these keyboard cases are not as good laptops as real laptops. They get close, but they're not, you know, they're not perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also wonder how it compares to coming from a PC notebook that's not one of the higher end ones, or coming from the 13 or 15 inch MacBook before the redesign, you know, when it had the diving board trackpad and it was not very large, you know, it was normal size versus like extra large. So
yeah, it feels a lot like like my previous, so before the 2016 and the 2012, which was not, you know, fancy trackpad, that was the old classic. It feels a lot like that, except the trackpad's smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you know, take from that what you, and the keys, the key travel is low. People keep asking me, what do the keys feel like? I would say 12-inch MacBook style.
Uh-huh. Like, have you used a smart keyboard where it's like the part of the case?
I wish I have, but I haven't.
Okay.
Because I've just been using my iPad like for entertainment. Like my personal iPad Pro is the 2015 12.9-inch. And, I've never paired a keyboard to it before because I just like, I don't know. I just use it for like video and right. YouTube and blazing around and stuff. So I've never been like, you know, I'm actually going to do like proper work on it. So I've never actually bought the keyboard accessories before. The Logitech keyboard is not like the fabric keys, right? It's like plastic keys inside.
It has a fabric cover, but not over the keys, huh?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, like the actual like case itself is kind of like fabric-y, but it's got like a plastic, I guess you'd say, chassis to it, right?
And sure.
It's like fabric that covers it. Yeah. So it feels a lot like typing like a 12-inch MacBook, which is fine. You know, you get used to it.
Yep, and it's available for the 10.2-inch iPad and the 10.5-inch iPad,
which is called the iPad Air, yeah.
Air 3, yeah. But
and it would work with the old 10.5-inch Pro. Like, uh-huh. There's no reason it wouldn't.
Okay, because it has a smart connector, and that's what it's based on.
Yeah, yeah, because the 10.5-inch iPad Air is basically like the old Pro, right? Like,
yeah.
Because that's why the old keyboard, they didn't even need to change the keyboard for it to work. But if you go on the Apple Store site, it doesn't mention 10.5-inch Pro compatibility, because I don't think they don't list stuff they don't sell, right? And the Apple Store doesn't sell the old 10.5-inch Pro, so it's not listed there.
And then the only other one to consider would be the 9.7-inch iPad Pro, which, you know, they had the big iPad Pro that you have, and then they made a 9.7-inch version in that first year before they had 10.5 and then 11-inch. But that one, the body's different than the 10.2-inch, right? Because the 10.2-inch is the body of the 10.5, essentially.
Yes, yeah. And so everything's in different places. And mm-hmm.
Although they are two distinct different cases that you purchase for the 10.2 and 10.5, but it's different enough from the 9.7 that it wouldn't work. So.
Yeah, I'm not actually sure what the difference is between the iPad Air version and the 10.2-inch one.
Yeah. They're different like purchases that you can make, but yeah. All right, well,
yeah, I'd recommend it if people want one. It's a shame they don't. It's a shame like the Apple arrangement means they haven't made a version for the bigger pros, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If they could, if it was like $200 versus, you know, $350 for the 12.9-inch one,
and they have
you're basically paying the extra cost is basically like the cool stand, which is very cool.
Yeah,
but do you necessarily need it? I don't know.
And Logitech does have new keyboards for the iPad Pro, just not trackpads on them, but they're. Like that's part of the new set collection of cases, though. It's like for the iPad Pro, Logitech has a new keyboard that's like, I guess, like what you've got minus the trackpad.
Correct. Yeah. And maybe over time they'll like expand the range, but clearly they had an exclusivity agreement for the launch.
Yeah, and so my curiosity is, I'm really inclined to get one for my daughter Emily for her iPad because she's 7 and her iPad is like. You know, it's her computer. And right now with COVID-19, the schools are closed for the rest of the school year. So it'll be until August, late August, when she goes back to the classroom. And so she has daily assignments that she does through her iPad. And, you know, she's got the smart keyboard and I let her use the magic mouse, you know, to try out the cursor stuff. And she liked the cursor stuff because she could break down words she was reading using the cursor to, you know, kind of divide the words up. And, you know, that was just her acceptance of it. And that was cool to see. But, you know, I think if it was a built-in thing, you know, the keyboard and the trackpad as part of the case, then she'd use it even more than needing to worry about a mouse with AA batteries at her desk. But the only thing is she recently had a small crack in her iPad, so I'm not sure if I want to really invest more in that one or not.
It's already a write-off.
Yeah. So I probably won't do anything in the meantime. But my older brother, though, is looking to get his first iPad now, and he was looking at, you know, he wants a keyboard case with it, and I was like, you really should consider this one, talking about the 10.2-inch one, because you can get them for as low – brand new is $279. Amazon has them for that.
Yeah.
For gold and black. Silver is $299. And then Best Buy has them for $299 across the board, which I think they price match anyway. But, you know, $280. And then the bottom half of it is almost as much at $150. But, it, you know, it helps out. So, It's an interesting thing, and I, you know, hope to see after this exclusivity period that there's more options, like you said. So surely. All right, something else that's new this week is for the Mac Pro, and this was just an absolutely fun story to write, because we kind of had a day of big releases on Wednesday. And what's new for the Mac Pro...
And this was the most expensive.
Yeah, wow. It's the way I put it in my story is the iPhone SE is aggressively priced, and these are aggressively priced in a very different way. Mac Pro Feet Kit you can purchase now for $300. And they say, use the Mac Pro Feet Kit to install stainless steel feet to the bottom of your Mac Pro. The standard Mac Pro comes with 4 feet already installed, but if you purchase a Mac Pro with wheels, you can spend $300 more to have these. It includes a hex bit, so that's what you need. And
you need other stuff.
Yeah, they say, but additional tools are necessary.
So for your $300, they didn't give you the entire toolkit.
They give you the hex bit, but not everything you need. And they say replacing the wheels with feet reduces approximately 1 inch to the height of the frame. And so it's, you get 4 very, very shiny stainless steel feet for your Mac Pro for $300. Okay, not bad.
Not bad.
Yeah, and then you get to the wheels, and those are $700 for the Mac Pro Wheels Kit. And they say, put your Mac Pro on wheels with the Mac Pro Wheels Kit. The custom design stainless steel and rubber wheels make it easy to move your Mac Pro around, whether sliding it out from under your desk or across your studio. Installation required. A quarter inch to 4 millimeter hex bit is included, but additional tools are required. Replacing the Mac Pro feet with wheels adds approximately 1 inch to the height of the frame. So,
and they are priced at
$700. Still cheaper, as I put in the story, it's still cheaper than $1,000 Pro stand for the Apple Display XDR. Okay.
Although on raw materials, you're probably getting a better deal on the stand just for how much bigger it is compared to the four little feet.
I totally get the Mac Pro is expensive because it's for an audience who needs that kind of power, and it's in their budget to pay for it, and it saves them money in the long run. I don't know how this works out to be anything but a premium accessory for a premium product. So,
They're just so expensive.
It's comical.
Because when the Mac Pro was first launched, obviously you could add the wheels for $400.
So yeah.
They said they were going to add the wheel kit later. I was like, oh, it's going to be a $400 purchase. And so, yes, $400 is still insane for the wheels.
$100 per wheel, sure.
$100 per wheel. But then what it turns out with, they consider the $599 price point to include the feet. So you have to subtract $300 from the $700 that the wheels actually cost. Because apparently, in their mind, each wheel will cost you $175, basically. Like, it's... honestly, complete madness.
Yes, yeah.
People are going to pay it, I guess, because
maybe, yeah.
It's 20 grand machines, and you suddenly need some wheels. Well, you don't really have a choice.
Yeah, it's like you regret not getting them in the first place, or you got them, and you regret it, and you want to be less portable, so yeah, pay $300 more. It's wild. Those feet are a good bargain compared to the wheels, though.
They also started selling the GPU option, right?
Yeah, it's the Radeon Pro W5700X and PX module GPU. So,
and I believe that is $1,000.
Yeah.
So you can either have 4 feet for $700, or you can have an entire decently spec graphics card for a grand. Like, I know what I'd choose.
Or, I mean, you can buy, one and a half of the new iPhones. So that's fine. All I can say is that's fine.
It is a really bad deal.
Yeah, your tweet was immediate, and good job.
Accurate.
Yes. AirPods Pro tips. So when we reported a few weeks ago on this podcast that we were like stopping the podcast for a moment to write this story about the new iPhone SE, we'd actually seen this for the AirPods Pro, but we didn't know quite what was going on because you can get replacement parts for AirPods, you know, the tips included through the Genius Bar, but you couldn't purchase them on their own. Now you can. I don't think that's a very good deal either, but it's more affordable. It's $8 to purchase. What is it? Two pairs of one size?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So your AirPods come with three pairs of sizes. So you've got small, medium, and large, and now you can buy for $799 two pairs of any of those sizes. So you can spend $8 on two mediums, two smalls, or two larges. So that's easier than going to the Genius Bar if that's what you need. So That's the big release of the week. It's the wheels and the pro tips. And then there's a new iPhone. So
there is.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, the iPhone SE. Yeah.
Who would have thought it was going to be called that?
Yeah. It was. You know, I think that everything in our report held up. Last week, I didn't acknowledge it. You know, just because we discussed it before in the podcast. It's like, you know, who knows what happens between recording and release. But if you read our story, which we never changed any word of it, it was all like from the moment it never changed.
Someone started spreading rumors that it was like rewritten. It was like never changed.
Yeah. I had to go back and look at the revision history just to make sure. Like I did like a screen recording and I was willing to like tweet it. But, the folks I were talking to were like, it's okay. I believe you. But I think some of it was like manipulated because in the report, we called the release imminent because the way that we found out was that, you know, it can only be imminent. This can't be for like, you know, June. It would be very weird for it to be for like late, you know, late.
It was like signs that Apple was like ready to press the release button, but we didn't know when they were going to press the release button, basically.
That's right. Yeah. And so we said as soon as tomorrow, being Friday, we wrote it on a Thursday, which meant, you know, we don't know if it's tomorrow, but it could be. We don't want to rule it out. Personally, I wanted to say that because, you know, if it happened tomorrow, then it'd be like, see, as soon as tomorrow. But then you lobbied for us to say like, you know, as soon as next week or you know, likely next week.
Yeah, because I think we talked about this on the podcast, right? Like when we saw what we saw, I was thinking, oh, okay, it's going to come like the Tuesday, the following Tuesday.
Yeah.
Right. You know, like a standard release cycle because Apple never releases products on Friday. Like they never announce products on Friday. It just never happens. But obviously it took them, you know, a week and a half later than more than that. But
yeah. Well, the reason I didn't disqualify that Friday was because of COVID-19 and all stores, but in China and now South Korea being closed still. Then I could see them saying like announcement and then pre-order is the same announcement. And then so it's a Friday pre-order and then like the next Friday it ships, which is, I mean, they did do that, a Friday pre-order of this week and then next week it ships next Friday. But they did it, you know, the 2 days before the pre-order announcement. So, but the story itself was like, so for example, like the way that we needed to frame the timing was based on the source and the type, we can sort of editorialize what the timing would be. But then what wasn't sort of, you know, assumed or so is the name of the phone, which is iPhone SE, which, you know, the community had been wild about iPhone 9 or iPhone SE 2 or iPhone SE 2020 or something, but, you know, it ended up is iPhone SE, just like last time.
We said this on the show, right? That I thought iPhone 9 was like ridiculous proposition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said that.
Yeah, because it's the newer chip, like it wasn't. It was always rumored all along that it was the A13 chip. Mm-hmm. So they were never going to, in my eyes, they were never going to call it like the 9 because it just sounds too old.
I did see one tweet of somebody asking today if the 9 is still coming though. Because they don't want this thing. They want the 9. I don't know. But so the name iPhone SE, the three colors, which, you know, Quo had said space gray, silver, and red. So like ballpark estimate, you know, red was the big one there. What we had was black, white, and red. So not space gray, but black, and not silver, but white, and then red. And what they ended up doing was really interesting. You know, it was what we reported, but they're all, I didn't even consider this, but they're all black glass on the front. So if you get the white model, it's like back in the iPhone 3GS days, I believe it's been that far back, when or if you count the 5C, but that was plastic. Well, I guess 3GS was too. But anyway, you've got a black glass on the front and white glass on the back with like a silver band around the sides. And I think it's a really cool look to it. That's neat. I like that.
When you point that out, it's like, oh yeah, I remember those days because do you remember for a while they remember the first red iPhone 7 they did?
Yeah, it was the white.
Where it was white front and it was so bad.
Yeah, everyone.
And then they did the next year, they did the iPhone 8 in red, right? And then that was properly black front, red back. That was clearly the way to go. Even like they've obviously done it on all the newer phones because it would look weird with the true depth notch and all the sensor stuff in there. If you put white, there'd be so many random black holes of the actual sensors there that it looks stupid. But even for the phones that still have the thick bezels, and that means just the SE now, it definitely just looks better black on the front, even if you've got a white back.
Yeah, especially with the screen off. I mean, when they did the marketing for the Red 8 and 8 Plus, like, it was all dark marketing, so that the screen looked like it was like OLED, you know, or all screen, for example. But those are the colors. And like I said, I mean, I think you like the way that the all black one looks, because it's like just cleaner than the back of the phone's cleaner than the back of current phones, you know, the camera situation.
It's like, yeah, so it's proper black, right?
Not space gray, but not space black,
gray, yeah. Like deeper black. And the SE only has one camera, and it's still the camera itself is bumped up, but you don't have the wonky square arrangement around it, because you don't have like the dual camera system or anything like that. So you just have like an iPhone XR style single camera that's elevated beyond the back. So it's a really nice, like, elegant finish where you got proper black and then just one little camera on the end. Mm-hmm. That's in pure, you know, in terms of pure aesthetics. Of course, that means that you don't get, you know, an ultrawide lens or a zoom lens or anything like that. But just the pure physical design, it's on the back, it's probably the prettiest one they have right now, mm-hmm. like of the entire lineup.
Yeah, and then I like the punkiness of the black front and the white back. But I, you know, reporting on these all day and then needing to, you know, like read the website on these and everything, then looking at my iPhone 11 Pro Max, like just from looking at it, I was like, that white one does look neat, and, you know, collect it. But I quickly pulled out my iPhone. It's like, oh, this is modern. This is different in so many ways, that, you know, there was a lot of reporting that was like, the iPhone 11 and 11 Pro were always overpriced. Here's proof. And, you know, but it's just not the case. Like, there are such differences. It's as much as the same as when we were in the iPhone 7 days and thinking, man, these phones are just not modern compared to what competitors are doing. We can't wait for the 10. And the 10, like, you know, fulfilled our desire for our modern looking phone. These are back to those days. But, you know, and so the new stuff looks even more modern. But what they did inside is what counts for this market.
Yeah, like, you can definitely argue that the Pro line is overpriced, but the SE isn't the evidence for it, right?
No,
like,
yeah.
The SE, it's good value for what it is, and it's definitely the best value iPhone that Apple sells. But I don't know, It just looks so old. That's I was done with bezels 2 years ago while, you know, Apple didn't even have the bezel-less options. And now that they do, it just looks insane to me. Like, even though the processor's, you know, 2 years newer, pretty much, like, the 10R just seems like way more attractive.
Yeah, if you get
Face ID and you get like the full screen look, and you actually get the bigger size because it's 6.1 inches, whereas this is 4.7, like, mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, totally. Yeah. If I were recommending like family or friends to purchase a new phone, and it wasn't like me in college 10 years ago would love this phone for the price, and that you get a modern chip in it, so you feel good about that, and a great camera. But if I were recommending to family or friends to buy a new phone, and like they weren't going to go for pros, but they weren't sure about the 11 cost, then looking at a 10R, you know, would be like that. That's like your what you want to look at, because the chip difference in a 10R and in the SE now is not dramatic. And I'm not sure. I you know, there are some things you can't do with an iPhone 10 or 8, but it's not a whole lot of difference there. Like,
yeah, so the 10R has the A12 chip, right? Whereas this has A13.
Yeah.
So. But and the jump between A12 and A13 was not ginormous.
Right. I mean, it's still A12 is still in the new iPads, right?
Yeah, and the 10R is nowhere close to being dropped off the OS support list, right? Yeah. Like, it will be supported for 4 years more at least.
Yeah. What you don't get with the 10 or the 8 is one portrait effect or so, which is the one with the white background.
Oh yeah, the high key mono one.
Yeah, you don't get that. You do get that with the new SE. So,
well, blow me over.
yeah. I mean, it's a better phone than the 8 was, and it's a better price, and it's a better, you know, that's what you compare it to. And if you have the iPhone 6, you cannot run iOS 13. So you're not up to date there. You know, you can't get,
yeah, I mean, the,
it still gets updates, but
4.7 inches. This is 4.7 inches. That is like a clear upgrade path for people, and it gets you into the world if you do want to play arcade games, mm-hmm. or if you do want to, you know, do augmented reality stuff, which Apple is clearly pushing for mm-hmm. more and more.
Yep.
And they're not going to stop. Like, this is the thing you got to do. And if you trade in your iPhone, you can get, you know, $30 off or whatever, and then you this pushes that $350 price. It pushes that $399 down to $350, and 64 gigs of storage is pretty respectable, right? Like.
Yeah,
I upgrade mine to 256, but I don't feel bad recommending 64 gig phones to people. Like, I feel like that's fine.
Yeah, I saw some people saying you should never buy a 64 gigabyte phone, and the 128 is only $50 more. But it's such a big difference in like paying for iCloud or not paying for iCloud. Like, that's a big difference. For this,
the problem is you should kind of pay for iCloud anyway.
Yeah, like, well, you need
like,
to.
Because you don't want to rely on the onboard storage as your one copy of the data.
Like, yeah, but
you don't really have a choice, right? Like, you kind of have to submit your soul to Apple and at least pay him 99 cents a month, right? Like,
yeah. If I told my dad to get a 256 gigabyte phone and he didn't have iCloud storage, then he'd still see that warning that you're out of space because it's iCloud storage. I see it all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And you're not actually backing up your pictures.
Yeah, so that's what you should focus on with that $50 difference. I think for most people, it's pay for iCloud storage, even if it's a, you know, $12 a year.
Yeah, that's 5 years of basically using your phone versus getting the extra storage, plus when you probably need the iCloud anyway.
Yeah, and yeah, exactly. So 64,
like, that's
just
a fact of life
good.
Right now. Like, you should be paying to back up your pictures. You can turn off every other little toggle on the iCloud screen if you really want to, but you need to pay to back your pictures, because you lose them and you'll be like distraught, right? Like, yeah. It's just
I hear from family all the time, and they're like, I've got the new phone because my old phone was out of space, and I'm still getting this warning on it, and what do I do? And I say, well, you either pay for iCloud storage, which you should do, or if you just toggle off photos, they'll only be on your phone. You got to connect to a computer to back them up, or, you know, get into Google Photos or something else. But no, people don't like to do that. So.
Yeah, people don't want to do it. And I 100% think that Apple should, you know, morally, ethically, whatever angle you want to go from, they should offer free photo storage when you're buying their devices, right? Like, I almost wish they would just, like, add in an extra $20 to the price of these phones just so they could, like, pay for the cost of it, rather than, because it's so important to people. And, like, you know, I take that over any of these little features they add that probably cost the same amount of money. Like, it's just so critical to people's, like, happiness. And they don't, but people will not psychologically pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in 2 years' time when they lose their phone and all the pictures disappeared, they're, like, you know, so, so sad at just all these lost memories and lost life. Like, it's such a bad thing. And it is annoying where you have to say, look, you just have to pay $1 a month. But you do just kind of have to pay $1 a month because you don't have a better option. There's no, unless you want to, you can do Google Photos, I guess, right? If you don't want to pay anything, you can at least install Google Photos, and they will upload all your photos for free at lower resolution, which is fine. But I prefer Apple's solution where they all integrate in the Photos app, so I pay them money. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So the happy hour stands on storage is that if you're looking at 64 versus 128 because you've got a lot of photos, you know, and you want to be able to take more, then closely examine if it's actually iCloud storage that you need more of, and that you'd be fine with 64. Cause that's another thing is, like, I get the larger phones usually too, but I got to a point where I was still needing to offload the photos to iCloud for storage reasons. It just had more than what the base phones have. And if you've got a copy on your Mac that's backed up, then it kind of feels, you know, just like you're paying way too much to carry around in your pocket too. So the last one I got was the lowest storage option because I needed to offload to iCloud anyway. And then if you pay, you know, even more to iCloud, you can have up to 2 terabytes for that library. But then on the USC, I mean, it is nice that from day one, they include a third option, which is 256 gigabytes. And, I think this wasn't reported before our story. So 128 and 64 were, but 256 was brand new to our report,
correct,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but the official happy hour stance is go 64 and look at your iCloud storage, unless you 100%. Have an explicit need.
We are sponsored this week by Pillow. Getting a good night's sleep is underrated, but with a little help, it can be life-changing. Pillow is an all-in-one sleep tracking solution to help you be more aware of your sleep patterns and discover what might be affecting your sleep quality. If you have an Apple Watch, tracking your sleep is as easy as wearing it to bed. Pillow will track and analyze your sleep automatically. One of Pillow's most loved features is the ability to get a detailed heart rate diagram of every sleep session. You can compare your sleep quality with your weight, your steps, your caffeine consumption, many more health metrics to discover how they might be affecting how you sleep. You can enable recording and Pillow will save the sounds that you make during sleep. From sleep talking to sleep apnea, snoring, unexpected noises that might be affecting your sleep, a lot of users have been surprised by the results. And Pillow is very privacy minded. All your sleep and audio data is encrypted and stored on your device. And when it's stored to iCloud, it's using end-to-end encryption. Pillow doesn't have user accounts, so you can use it anonymously, and it doesn't collect or send your personal data anywhere else. Now, naps boost your focus, creativity, and overall well-being, and Pillow supports that too. If you're working from home, you can try taking a nap using Pillow's power nap modes. And if you need an alarm to wake up, Pillow can wake you up using your iPhone, Apple Watch, or iPad. And it even takes advantage of the WatchOS 6 feature, extended runtime, to minimize battery consumption on the watch. Pillow is available now on the App Store for the iPhone, Apple Watch, and iPad. Discover all of Pillow's features at naybox.com/pillow. That's spelled naybox.com/pillow. Sleep well and stay safe. Our thanks to Pillow for their support of 9to5 Mac Happy Hour. Well, while we're talking about photos, we should mention the camera situation. So,
sure, yeah.
It's not the iPhone 11 camera.
On paper, it's the... Is it on paper, like specs-wise, is it different from the 8?
I think the aperture is slightly different.
Okay, huh.
So it's the single lens from the previous year. So what the 10R had is that camera hardware, right? But obviously combined with the more modern image signal processing in the A13 chip. So you get the newer version of like Smart HDR, but you don't get night mode, for instance.
Yeah, no night mode, which is a big one for folks.
Yeah, and the like technical like amount of light coming into the sensor is not as much as you get on the iPhone 11.
Yeah, you know, the bezel situation is like why you call it the SE, and it has a Touch ID, so it's a callback to a past design. And with modern internals, but I think if it had night mode, then you could probably justify calling it in the 11 family, like, you know, 11 modifier, but not having like night mode kind of is what signals that it's in the 11 family, because that's like the big thing for the cameras in the 11 family.
Yeah, for sure. You have the industrial design with the Face ID and the screens, and then it's like, you know, what do people remember from the iPhone 11 generation specifically? It's like the camera night mode, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right?
That's basically it. So it's disappointing that it's not the, you know, it's not the the latest lens, but I don't think it matters too much. Like, it's for the price you're getting, I think it's fine. And if it was me and like you were putting things on the table, like what would you pick over instead? I would pick the thinner bezel screens like way sooner than, you know, upgrading the camera like one generation forward. If you could, you know what I mean? Like if those were on the table. So for me, it's a low priority, but it's, you know, it's good to mention it. And you still get the algorithmic portrait mode stuff, kind of like what the iPhone XR had.
Yeah, I'm looking at the cast version of the iPhone 8 technical specs and then the new version of the SE technical specs side by side. And from what I see, the camera, both were 12 megapixel wide cameras with 1.8 apertures. So I think the apertures are the same. From what I could tell, so I guess you get...
Yeah, so you said you're comparing to the iPhone 8.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's correct. It's different to the iPhone 11.
Okay, different than the 11.
You see what I mean? So yeah, it's not like the iPhone 11 camera, it's the iPhone XR camera, which is the iPhone 8 camera.
Yeah. But then you do gain the portrait mode stuff with the single lens, which is new versus the 8, right? The 8 was... Yeah, that was part of the chip for the 10R. Yeah, nice, yeah.
And the red one is product red?
It's product red, which is usually the fund to assist the fight against AIDS. And this time, it's a little bit different through the summer, at least, because I believe just product red, the organization, is doing this change where through the summer – the money goes to COVID-19 relief And then like at the end of the summer, then it'll shift based, you know, if circumstances change. But so for now, at least this iPhone SE in red, a portion of proceeds go to the COVID-19 relief effort. You know, my thought on seeing that was, if you like the color red as a phone, then go for that. But there are so many ways you can make a difference and you know, known amounts of money versus like an unknown amount of money that you're going to put into this. And that Apple, regardless of you making a purchase, has made dramatically big donations that are, would probably make this look like nothing, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the, if you look at all time, product red donations from Apple, it's only like 220 million or something. And that's, yeah. And that's all time as in back to like 2003 when they started doing it.
Yeah.
Which feels a bit cheesy. They always have it like so promoted when clearly the percentage of sales is very, very small, but yeah, that's kind of like a personal grind. if you want to support COVID-19 charities, just donate it directly.
Mm-hmm. Or rest assured that as an Apple customer, your money has been used in some part to already make a sizable donation.
You can put it on that way. I have a philosophical question, which I don't actually know the proper answer to, but I'd say the last like 4 years, it was the best value for money Apple device you could buy was the 329 iPad.
Yeah, if you have no phone or computer and you need to spend money to get online, the 329 iPad is the best way to get there. Otherwise, you're going to spend much more money than that for probably something that's not as, you know, might not be as good.
So does the SE represent better value for money now than what you can get from the iPad? Like, if you had like an iPhone 6 and an iPad Air, both of which can't update to the latest version of the operating system, but you only had like $400 to spend, so you can only buy one or the other, what's your better buy? Is it the phone upgrade or is it the iPad upgrade? Like, I think the phone's a decent, you know, entry model, but I kind of still feel like the iPad is better value.
Yeah, if it's your only internet access or your portal into the internet, then having the bigger canvas is a better tool. If you don't have Wi-Fi access anywhere, then you want to have something with cellular built in, and you end up paying for that as well. So it's not going to be a value there, but it's going to be, you know, the least you've got. So I think it comes down to like if miniaturization and built-in cellular is high on your priorities than the phone is, but for just a basic computer that you can access the internet from with Wi-Fi, then the iPad still remains the best value, even with the chip difference and everything.
And thinking like upgrading from what you already had in this hypothetical world, we had like the last devices that couldn't get the iOS 13, mm-hmm. right? So yeah. With the iPhone 6, you wouldn't be upgrading your screen size at all. It would still be 4.7 inches. Whereas on the iPad upgrade, you're actually getting a slightly bigger screen. Plus, you're getting like Touch ID because the iPad Air didn't even have Touch ID. Mm-hmm. So, and the cameras are way better. Like I feel like the iPad's probably still the best value Apple product there is, but it's close. It is more down to like, do you actually need a phone or not? Do you know what I mean? Like it's more down to what you need versus just raw price.
Yeah, either a phone that makes phone calls and send and receive text messages, or internet in your pocket if you're not on a hotspot, you know, because that's the factor there. But you pay a premium for those things, plus you pay the connection fee every month.
I think it's good that both of these products exist and Apple sells them. But I definitely feel like if you buy the cheap iPad, you feel pretty current. Whereas you buy the cheap phone, you still feel like you're getting like the bad deal because it's like the old version. Do you know what I mean? And it's just kind of like a sad state of affairs that it's going to be even longer before they can bring like the bezel-less design for the phone down the line.
Yeah. And you can imagine this phone, like right now it's in line with the 11 family of phones based on the processor alone. But that they keep it on the market for several years. And so that's no longer the case next year or the year after. It becomes even more of a gap.
Well, there's rumors that the...
Yeah, I was going to ask, what's Quo saying on Plus models?
Yeah, so the Quo situation currently is that in 2021, so next year, in the first half of the year, so around, you know, the normal time the SE gets refreshed anyway, in like the springtime, there'll be the SE Plus, and that will have the Touch ID sensor in the power button on the side. So you would get more thinner bezels. Mm-hmm. So you would actually, it wouldn't just be like the iPhone 8 Plus yeah, with a new chip in it. It would actually have a different industrial design, which is interesting.
Yeah, it'd be the first time they redesign something that isn't the highest end, it sounds like. And maybe that in that regard, you get the 10R out of the lineup, you know, and this is a new thing. Because it's kind of this gets rid of the 8 in the lineup. Even the 8 Plus, there's no size replacement for it, and you can only buy it through Apple sales channel, but not through Apple directly. But maybe the 8, the SE Plus is the 10R replacement, where this is the 8 replacement.
Yeah, and at least if, you know, Crow's correct, they're definitely, like, not abandoning Touch ID full stock. Because the other option they could have done is, like, take the iPhone XR and just give it a newer chip and then just sell it at $499. Do you see what I mean? Next year.
Yeah.
Because that would be plus size, because it's 6.1 inch screen, right? Mm-hmm. And it would have Face ID and stuff. But what the angle Crow seems to be suggesting is that they would keep the fingerprint recognition around just in a different form while making the screen bigger. It's an interesting equation.
Yeah. In chip aside, if Apple were to keep the iPhone X, which is the same era as the same release date or, you know, release cycle as the 8, that has the new design and then has dual cameras with the portrait stuff.
I think the OLED's still expensive for them, though. That's the problem.
You think so? Okay. Because I was wondering if they kept that around, how cheap could they get it? Because you do see it still sold from, you know, the retail channels that are not Apple. But it usually it's like $800 and not $400. So
yeah, the 10R is sold right now for $599, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so you can imagine that in a
so that's LCD versus OLED.
A few months' time, it could be $500, right? Yeah. Like, whereas I still feel like the iPhone X, just the OLED screen's too expensive for them to actually get it down that low, to get it down that low while maintaining their profit margins that they want.
Sure, yeah. iPhone X is a really good phone. If you still have one, it's a really good phone.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation. Like, the iPhone 11 was great value, but it's $699. Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. And the SE is pretty good value, but it's like the crusty old design that no one wants. It's kind of a shame, but that's kind of how it plays. Like, I guess what I'm thinking is, like, if you had the iPhone like 4S and then you waited 4 years, your upgrade would be a phone that looked different. Whereas if you had like the iPhone 6 and you waited like 4 or 5 years, your upgrade's like a phone that basically looks the same.
Yeah, it all
depends. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a weird time because the pretty new design series is still too expensive for them to get down to that like lower end.
Yeah, if you prefer Touch ID, then this is a win for you. If you want a much smaller screen, there's no new option there, but that wasn't expected. My mom and my dad and my stepmom, my dad has an iPhone 6, so that's iOS 12, and I bought him the iPhone 6 only because I wanted him to be able to use the Apple Watch, and he had an iPhone 5C, which couldn't pair with the current Watch OS at the time. And so that's why I upgraded him to a 6, and then it got out, you know, now it doesn't update. And he can't get the latest Watch OS, but that's okay. My stepmom last year for her birthday, I bought her a 6S because that was then like the $100 phone with their service. And for both of them, they were coming from the iPhone 5C with 8 gigabytes of storage. And so even the old stuff now was a big upgrade for them. You know, that's a 2-generation leap, basically, in terms of the internals, and then a 3-generation leap. So, you know, but this new SE is an upgrade target. Granted, it's 4 times what I paid for their phones at the time then, you know. I think the 6S is still kind of the $100 phone on their service, but you know,
that has longevity, that device.
Okay.
Like, I and as much as I like disdain on the bezel situation, mm-hmm. I definitely have to like acknowledge that there are definitely people that don't care. When I got the iPhone X, I took it to my like family or whatever. I was like, look at this. And they were like, what you
they didn't care,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, they didn't even like conceive it as like an important factor. So
my dad's FaceTime camera on his iPhone 6 doesn't work. He doesn't care. it's just the FaceTime call and you can't see him, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Like it's a good entrance into the lineup. It's not ideal in the perfect sense of the word, but I think it's like just about how far they can stretch.
Yeah, and response has been all over the spectrum where people, you know, there's some people that wanted a new iPhone SE sized phone, like the 4-inch size, which we never expected. And there are people who, in a perfect world, what Apple would do is take, you know, the full screen design and manage to make it, you know, more affordable, even if you had different things that you gave up on the phone. And what they did was, like, in the middle, where you got the nice internals and camera, you know, and you've got the old design. And that's probably the right move.
There is a bit of a glimmer of hope on the horizon if you're in that category, because the 5.4-inch phone that's coming out at the end of the year will be smaller than, you know, the 5.8-inch ones, obviously, and it's still bezel-less and nicely pretty.
Yeah.
It's not going to be as small as the 4-inch iPhone SE was, but...
And they like, still call this, like, the small phone. They reference it in size next to the 11, and so they're like, look at that big mammoth thing. This is much smaller. Even though the real comparison would be comparing it to, like, I guess the 10S or 11 Pro in size, you know, wise, because even though it's more expensive because of OLED and various things, then it's the closest in size to the SE.
Yeah, and people who are, like, complaining about the 4-inch size going away, like, that ship has sailed for so long now. Like, I loved your post. You did, what, it was probably, like, 2 years ago now, where you just had screenshots of using an iPhone SE in the modern era.
Yeah, and just so truncated. Much stuff with
truncated text everywhere, buttons didn't fit on the screen, you can only see, like, one thing at a time. And, you know, the simple reality is Apple designs all their new operating system features, like, it's based around... They're like iPhone 11 size screens first.
Yeah.
And everything else is kind of, like, on the big side, the Max and Plus phones, you know, they kind of don't get the attention they need to actually take advantage of that size. And then very short on the smaller end, you know, you're just getting something that's, like, shrunk down. It's not thought out for those sizes, and it just doesn't work for those sizes. It just feels like a toy. Like, it's just iOS design has shifted so that it doesn't fit inside a 4-inch canvas anymore.
Yeah.
It just doesn't.
I can speak to that point too, though. My older brother is just a few years older than me, and he cranks his text up. And then my mom and stepmom, or my mom, stepmom, dad, and my aunt, they all use massive text sizes and just don't care about, you know, if it, like, overflows from a button or whatever, or if it takes up three lines. But at least it's like the standard. You could see if they did care enough about optimizing for those screen sizes, the standard text size wouldn't truncate like it does. What I think I found interesting here is you do have the removal of 3D touch, so that's the pressure sensitive panel of the display, dated back to the 6S, was on the 8, and now they have haptic touch, so it just means they didn't have 3D touch hardware and they used the new software that was already there, I guess, if you had an iPhone 8 on iOS 13. But with no benefit to battery life, when you saw battery life improve with the removal of 3D touch with the 10S to the 11 Pro, for example. So what's up with that?
Yeah, we're going to have to wait for, like, teardowns for sure, but I think they're just kind of, like, using the same battery or not taking advantage of the extra, like, millimeter of space they gained from removing the 3D touch hardware. Yeah.
And it is physically smaller too, so that, like, the diagonal size of the battery wouldn't be any different. It would just be the thickness, and it'd be a smaller addition, even if it is a larger battery inside. So.
Yeah, I think the current rumors are that the battery capacity is identical to the iPhone 8. So and Apple quotes the same battery life statistics as the iPhone 8. So that would line up.
And, like, I guess 3D touch, like, it was... Was it harder to do on the 10 phones and the Edge to Edge phones than...
Yeah, I think that was definitely, like, one of the explanations was on the... It was more expensive to do on the iPhone 10.
Yeah.
The 10S.
So it's kind of not a big deal on the... You know, like the 6 didn't have it, then the 6S added it, and then the 8 had it.
And it had to get thicker to do it.
That's true, yeah. They don't give you a spec difference in terms of weight or size from 8 to SE. So I guess they just keep the chassis the same, and if the battery is the same, then it just wasn't a big difference inside with 3D touch. But
yeah, I what you might find is just, like, there's some empty space there.
Yeah,
you
know what I mean? Right. Sure. Yeah.
It's just cheaper to do it that way.
Yeah, it's cheaper to not include than it was to include, and it was. Yeah,
and they're not going to include it when their top of the line phones don't have it.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
Like, maybe they would have used the space something else, but they definitely weren't going to keep it around, even if they could have, for the same price. Because, like, if the top of the phones didn't have it, people were crying, you know, hoarse about it. Like, why does the cheapest phone in the lineup have this thing that a lot of people still miss? Because the replacement, the long touch system, it's fine and you get used to it, but it's definitely not as nice as what we used to have. It just isn't.
Yep.
It's like the benefits of 3D touch were small, but they were benefits. They weren't, you know, it wasn't a downside, and we have lost those elements.
Yep. And then finally, what I've got on this is that, you know, they've got the A13 chip, but they don't include the U1 chip for the ultra wideband, which is probably just because of price, I imagine, for no other reason. But you do get the U1 chip in the 11 and the 11 Pro. So you don't get it in the SE, and that's totally okay. You do get express card support, which was a thing with the 8, but the difference now is power reserve. So if your phone's dead, you can still use your phone as like your express card to get into things with basically the Apple Pay method, but your phone's dead. And then Wi-Fi 6. So just like the iPhone 11 family of phones, I guess it's based on the A13, there's Wi-Fi 6 support for someday. It doesn't matter. Which is pretty good for the SE, cool.
See you in 3 years.
Yeah, which the SE is meant for, I'm sure it'll be sold in 3 years.
Yeah, it's definitely not a phone they're going to keep for one generation.
That's right, yeah. And then this is a funny thing, to me at least. We had reported that they had a case lineup planned. They released that on day one. $35 for the silicone cases and $45 for the leather cases. And the funny thing here to me is that because the 11 phone is meant to be like that, it's not the Pro, so they say leather cases for the Pro, you can only get silicone cases for the 11.
But the SE has leather cases.
The SE gets leather from day one, even though it is like actually like the most affordable in the lineup. The reason is that they did leather for 8 anyway, so here's 3 case options for you. I think it's like I think it may be like black and navy and pink sand. It's just that's a funny. Weird thing. Yeah. I saw iPhone 11 owners that were upset about that. So had to give them the shout out. So, all right, let's talk about a couple more things this week. But the first thing is Bloomberg has a new report on the high end over ear Apple headphones. And this is from our pal, Mark Gurman, and he has a twist on the rumor. So what's new this week there?
Yeah, it's such a mouthful to describe this thing because you don't want to step on the toes of Apple's existing over-ear headphones from the Beats lineup. These are the rumored, long rumored now. Like, they were first rumored in 2018, and then they've clearly been delayed a couple of times. And then apparently now they're coming out this year, although with the coronavirus situation, who knows? Everything still seems very in flux on, what gets prioritized in the supply chain. But specifically what was interesting in this Bloomberg report was that a new detail about like the design of the headphones. And so what Mark says is that they're developing 2 variations, one which would use like leather fabrics and then another with kind of like lighter breathing materials more suited to like fitness. So similar to what you see on the Apple Watch where you have like the sport bands and the Nike bands.
Or the cases, you have, like, silicone and leather there and the cases.
Yeah, the cases. Yeah, sure. And then obviously you have like the higher end watch bands as well. And Bloomberg makes this comparison to the Apple Watch in the story because apparently these Apple headphones are going to have like this kind of modular customization aspect to them where the ear pads and the frame and the headband padding attach like magnetically to the core body. And so you'd be able to like mix and match on the go. And so if you wanted, like a fancier, more stylish one, you could flick them on and connect them. And if you wanted, like gym style over ear headphones, you'd put on the rubber and the plasticky bits. And apparently existing headphones from like competing manufacturers in the space offer similar kind of magnetic customization with magnetic ear pads, but Apple wants to go a bit further and have like customization on kind of all 3 parts of it, which would potentially mean that the same set of headphones could be convertible from a comfort fitness use case to a more like stylish commuting kind of situation, which is a detail that we haven't had discussed before.
I like the use of magnets because it just gives me more hope for magnetic charging on these things.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually.
I don't want to plug a wire into these things. And if they're in the AirPods family, then that's kind of unheard of. So that's a cool thing. And then finally, we have this news that Apple and Google are working on software updates and a new API for contact tracing, is what they're calling it. And that is a method to eventually determine if you've been in contact with someone based on your phone's Bluetooth signal who in the last 14 days has tested positive for COVID-19. And you really have to pay attention to this stuff to kind of learn what it is and what it is not. Because just if you listen to that, it kind of sounds like you've got a map of everyone you've interacted with and like a ping, and you can kind of like identify who it was and everything. But I think the better way to think about it is just close your eyes. There's no map at all. It's just blips interacting, unknown, you know, no idea where it was, who they were. It's like AirDrop, where you don't have to have the person in your contacts to send to them. It's just the Bluetooth connection. So you're in that close proximity for a set amount of time. And then they go to the doctor within the next 2 weeks, and a doctor verifies they have COVID-19. You receive an alert on your phone, whether it's iPhone or Android, that someone who you've contacted with in the last 2 weeks has tested positive for COVID-19. And so you should be checked out as well. You know, you may not be symptomatic yet, but you were exposed at least. And there you go.
So the system's anonymous, and it's not actually sharing direct location.
In theory, you can have location services turned off, and this works the same way, because it just doesn't care where you are. It just cares that you're in proximity of somebody else. So, you know, I guess ideally it doesn't matter that you're, you know, ideally you could be without a cellular connection or a GPS signal. And
So it can actually do the tracing offline.
And that's kind of the big answer to privacy, is that you think about it, and it's not the big map from the Dark Knight Batman movie where, you know, you're using sonar sound to determine like where everyone in the city is. There's no visual element or no graphical elements or geography there at all. It's just that you've made contact, yes or no. Not where you were, you know, you may be able to figure it out based on what you did, but that's only you. And it's all on device in terms of making the connections. The server element is that when it's verified that you have COVID-19 and you tell your app that, or the doctor tells your app that, based on you opting into using the whole system in the first place, then it's Apple server. Or if it's a country that doesn't want Apple server, then the government in that country could use their own server. But that's the server element. But all the work is done on your phone, on device. So it's not off your device. So it's up to a medical professional to kind of put you in that database as positive. So and the idea is that, you know, the sooner you can find out that you have been exposed to COVID-19, someone who's positive, then you can quarantine for 2 weeks and not need to go out into the environment once, you know, mandated kind of statewide and countrywide quarantines are no longer required, so that there's not a big flare up again of this. And part of it is that you do need rapid testing to be able to determine, you know, hey, this app says I've been exposed. I need to find out yes or no.
Because if you can't get tested for 2 weeks, then it's too late, because everyone's harem walking around and spread it to the front and center.
It's literally useless, because you can't tell your app that, you know, there's no effect there. Apple and Google, on working on this, have built in, they're supporting a method that relies on a medical professional to verify you, and it doesn't have to be testing. So that they're kind of accounting for that. I suppose at that point, it's just having a doctor say you are symptomatic, so let's err on the side of caution and say that you are positive.
And you need some sort of like medical verification, because otherwise you get like idiots who just open the app and say I'm testing positive, and trolling alerts left, right, and center, and it's just completely useless.
Yeah, so that's what verification is for. And there's a few elements of this that are pretty interesting. Like, one is that there will be a software update to recognize the API. So just kind of based on sort of briefing on this, it's not definite yet, but it sounds like Apple will want to target more than just the iOS 13 devices. So that's the iPhone 6S and later. That probably iOS 12, which would bring in the 6 and 5S and the old SE and things like that, that would be supported as well. It comes down to hardware more than software, I think, because you can do those minor point updates to iOS 12 and bring this. It just needs to have the right Bluetooth chip to make this.
Yeah, it basically needs the Bluetooth LE support.
Yeah, exactly.
Because basically Bluetooth LE is short range enough that it can act as a proxy for being in contact.
And without smashing your battery life.
Yeah, and versus normal Bluetooth range, you know, can be like bigger than 15 feet. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So get more force positives. Like even with the LE, you are going to have like occasional things where like if I'm on one side of the wall and you're on the other side of the wall in a completely different room, you know, technically we haven't contacted each other, but that's just the limitation of Bluetooth. That's right. The technology we have to use, right?
Yeah.
Like, cause theoretically, if I was in like a block of flats and you got COVID-19 below me in the flat below and you stayed in your flat all day long, technically my phone's going to pick it up because it's going to go through the floor and be like, you've been exposed because you're near someone, but you're not actually. So that, you know, these systems are all best effort systems based on the things people have, which is everyone's got a phone in their pocket. Mm-hmm. Like there's no opportunity to send out custom devices that can work better for this. Like this is just what you have to deal with.
Yep. And so expect two software updates, one to support the API. The API will be used in an app that you download from the App Store, and the app's used to verify. So, you need the software update and you need the app to opt into the system because it's not mandated, but you do need to participate in it if you want the benefits. So you've got to say, I agree to participate in this system. And then the app is used, you won't have like a bunch of apps. You'll have one app per region. Like for example, in the US, it would be the CDC app. In the UK, you've got National Health Service. So, that would be your app. And so each region will have their regional health authority as the app. And that's kind of who it goes through. Then, and that's phase one, what they're calling phase one. And so there's the API, there's the app, there's the software support, you know, for the API. Then long term, and that's coming in mid-May, past mid-May in maybe June, July, or August, they want to build in this feature for the OS where you can at least opt into it without downloading an app. And so there will be some probably notification, just to some UI built into iOS itself that says you can participate in this feature and now you are. And you don't need the app until you are test positive. And so then your medical professional will say, download the app and, you know, I'll flag you as positive. Or if you know, so then you've got the app involved yet again.
Yeah. So in the theoretical phase two situation, you would like opt in to contact tracing on like a setup screen. So, you know, the screen where you have location services and Siri and one of those options would be contact tracing. And so you say, yes, I'm participating. And then if anyone near you reported as positive, you could get a push notification about it without having to actually download anything. So the adoption rate is going to be way higher than the phase one approach where you just have to, you know, you have to get everyone to go to the App Store to download the thing, to remember to update, to do everything else.
Yeah.
But the weird part in the phase two approach is that if you do test positive, you're at least in the current plan, you still have to download an app to report it, which feels kind of like a step too far for, you know, like for to make this widespread, it needs to be super, super simple. And if you're going to build in most of it to the operating system level, why don't you build in the reporting stage as well? Like I should be able to go into the health app and say, I'm testing positive, here's my, you know, doctor's note, upload it, and then let the health app, the Apple health app that's built into the phone, do the, you know, verification process. It seems like a bit silly that you're then gonna have to go to the App Store anyway to download the
thing. Yeah, I also think, you know, that Apple certainly has the mechanism in place to install apps on your phone in situations like a new phone has been flashed with certain apps from Apple that are from the App Store, not built in, but they're pre-installed, and so you can delete them. And then they're not like the hide the apps, they're uninstall the apps. So not the built-in apps, they're special. But like Apple Store or the iWork apps, for example, those are special. Those are included with the, I guess, the specific builds of iOS that come on new phones. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the mechanism that if you download an app on one device, you're presented with the opportunity to turn on automatic download so that you can download that app on your device, another device that you own and use where the app's available. So those are two existing things. What I think they could do in the phase one part of this plan, which includes an iOS update to recognize the API used by the app that supports it, why not have that build of iOS based on region include the app, you know, or a push of the server from the server to your phone to
like download the app for your region when you update.
Yeah, more than you know, now it's supported. Here's some release notes. Hope you read them and go get the app to even opt in. You know, it needs to be a big push of that app. That's more than just it's on the front page of the app store. If you look or know about it, you know, and
right. Yeah, like maybe just downloading the app is a bit of an overreach just in terms of like, you know, these are your personal devices in the day, but they should definitely, I would say they should send out like push alerts. So when you update, even if in the updates, one of the update steps, it will like prompt you to say, do you want to download the app for your region to help with contact tracing? Yes or no. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like maybe downloading it autonomously is not something they want to get involved in because there's, you know, a whole load of weeds there, but they should definitely like, they need to promote it because otherwise it's going to be pointless, right? Like, so, and I think that needs to be more aggressive than it just being somewhere in the app store. Like, maybe it's when you update, it says a little message, and then it can send you like a push alert. Even if maybe they're going to rely on the government systems, right? So the various governments have different ways of contacting the public. Like, I receive occasional text messages about the COVID-19 situation from the government, so maybe the government will, you know, when this rolls out, we'll say, you know, we want you to help out by downloading the contact tracing app for the NHS, and you can click in and get it. So I guess it's not entirely on Apple, but it definitely feels like they're leaving something on the table if they're not, you know, building in some UI to like prompt people to do it.
Yeah. And then on the Android side, it's that the update doesn't come from a software update to iOS, you know, the equivalent of iOS of Android, but it's an update that comes through the Google Play Store.
Yeah, because obviously Android in general has a lot of those kind of like semi-framework updates that can come through the Google Play Services layer rather than, you know, the full OS upgrades.
That's right. And so it also means it's not an update to several different versions of Android. It's just one new version in the Play Store for anyone that can access the Play Store. So if you've got 3 or 5 or 10 versions of Android that are all have modern access to the Play Store, then those will all get the right stuff in place.
Yes, that is correct.
Yep, nice.
Like, I think it's really good that these companies come together to do this, because before this announcement, there were a few different countries that were like, we're developing our app to let you can join our program and you can do it here. But I was always like so skeptical. I was like, if it's going to be so fragmented like that, it's going to be pointless. And even though these different regional apps are still going to be uploading their information to their own databases, the core functionality is unified across them all. And you can know that when Apple's like sanctioning the one app per region that's allowed to use the API, you get some confidence that these apps aren't doing something creepy behind the scenes, right?
That's right.
So they're only doing the anonymous contact identifier stuff. And like, if it was just left out to the Wild West, you'd have some governments doing it correctly with a fully anonymized system. You'd have other governments doing it weirdly with just like leaving your GPS on all day long. So this is definitely the way it has to be. And getting it cross collaboration between Google and Apple is good. Between Google and Apple is good too. And
yeah, even when you get to phase two, when it's in a system prompt to opt in, then adoption rates are still going to be a factor, and it's not going to be 100% because people, you know, for one, you've got to learn how this works to understand that it's not GPS, it's not location based at all, and then you still got to, you know, trust the system to some degree, but you know, at no point will everyone opt into this for various reasons. You will certainly have a higher adoption rate once it's a prompt in the OS versus knowing to go get an app to opt in. And then there's a question, question being, what percentage is required for this to even be useful? And, you know, it varies, you know, higher is better, 100 is better than zero. But there seems to be information around a study that says at least 50 to 60% is necessary for this to be at all effective. And then if you just break it down by like region, and, you know, it only works if the person you're in contact with has opted in too. You know, and instead of you opt out, then you're not a part of this network. You know, you don't benefit from the alert, but you also don't contribute either. So, yeah, but it's better than nothing. And
the chances of getting to 50% penetration are way higher now that Apple and Google are involved. Whereas before it was just everyone doing it on their own. Because when everyone was doing their own, you'd have been lucky to hit like 10%, I'm pretty sure.
But now it's
like a formalized thing. There's at least a chance it can hit those higher percentages and actually make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. And again, I really encourage people who are listening to go and look at, probably just Apple's announcement of this is good enough to understand what it is doing and what it isn't doing. Certainly, I hope our press coverage helps clarify it as well and then discuss it on the podcast. But
if I thought there was genuine like opportunity for
exploit
creepiness yeah. or weirdness or, misuse, I would be saying it. And I looked at the thing. They even had like pretty extensive like previews of the developer documentation about it. Seems perfectly legitimate what they're doing. It's completely anonymous opaque identifiers and with a very small admission that yes, someone is going to know that these anonymous identifiers were somewhere else. You're pretty in the clear in terms of like location privacy.
Yep. So maybe do your own research on this as well. And because if you do, then you're more empowered when you see news reports that this is scary and location based and GPS, and you can see those and say that's not actually true. So it helps to be informed. All right, that is the Happy Hour podcast for this week. Next week we will have a lovely discussion around the Magic Keyboard for iPad and more. So come back for that. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at ApolloZach, and I write space and news and history at spaceexplored.com. And Benjamin, you're on Twitter at
BZAMayo.
And you blog at
BZAMayo.com.
There we go. All right, we will be back next week. If you have any feedback, you can also email us at happyhour@9to5mac.com. We will see you then. Bye.
Bye-bye.